I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. 10 years ago, this past weekend, Lehman Brothers went belly up and the economy took a nosedive. Millions of Americans lost their jobs and millions lost their homes, the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. Wall Street was bailed out and no top banker was ever held responsible or sent to prison for causing such a catastrophe. We asked Jesse Eisinger to join us. He's a senior reporter and editor at ProPublica, author of The Chicken S. Club, Why the Justice Department Fails to Prosecute Executives. Back in 2011, he shared a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting on a series of stories about Wall Street practices that helped lead to the Great Depression. Jesse Eisinger, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
You're very welcome. Let's go back 10 years ago. What were we facing?
Well, we were facing, as you just said, the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. It had really started in 2007, building primarily because there was a major housing bubble in the United States, but also housing bubbles around the world in places like Spain and the UK, a huge credit bubble. Banks were lending recklessly and not really checking credit. And this had been building and building, and markets were freezing up, and it culminated in the crisis of September 2008.
Why has no one? I think there was one banker we've probably never heard of who actually went to jail or went to prison. Why no big bankers held responsible? One of the things you write about in your book is looking back at the Enron and S&L crisis. There have been previous bank crises in the past where people were held responsible. What was different about 2008?
Yeah, well, I think that this is the biggest or one of the biggest scandals of the Obama administration. And it's a complex story, which I tried to lay out in my book, because it's not a simple kind of thing where Tim Geithner ordered Eric Holder to stand down. But I think that the Justice Department has lost the will and ability to prosecute top corporate executives for complex white-collar fraud. And we have substituted holding individuals accountable with fines, corporate fines, and that's the way we enforce corporate wrongdoing in this country now, by fining companies. And it's a regime that is broken, it doesn't work, and it's fundamentally unfair.
I have asked this question of other people about why no one was held responsible, and the answer I have gotten is, well, what they did wasn't illegal. Can you answer that, Jesse?
Sure. Well, so obviously, since there were no prosecutions, I can't definitively answer, yes, this was illegal. But what we can say is that there are fundamentally mistakes about that argument. The first thing is that I'm not arguing that the financial crisis was caused by fraud. There was a lot of stupidity and recklessness, and stupidity and recklessness can be not criminal. But there was an enormous amount of fraud in the lead up to the crisis and in the aftermath. And in fact, that has been demonstrated in a lot of the settlements that the government has reached with banks. The settlements, some of them were civil, some of them were criminal. They outlined behavior that could have been charged against individuals for criminal behavior. So it's just wrong that there weren't crimes committed. The crimes committed were things like lying to the public about the state of your banks, lying to the public about the value of your assets, lying to the investors about what was going into these complex securities that were filled with mortgages. They were misrepresenting them as much better than they actually were. So there were myriad crimes that were committed, and the fundamental issue is that the Department of Justice didn't really look for the crimes, and if they didn't look, you're not going to find them.
As you mentioned, you write that the Justice Department essentially lost the will to go after white-collar crime. How come?
Well, after Enron, which you mentioned earlier, so there's a huge stock market bubble in the late 1990s, and it collapses in 2000. And when it collapses, it revealed a pandemic of accounting fraud. The most spectacular implosion was. Enron, one of the world's biggest companies and an energy trader out of Texas, but there was WorldCom, there was Adelphia, there was Tyco, Global Crossing. Older listeners will remember these names.
Sure.
And most of those top executives were from most of those companies were prosecuted. There's an era where we still knew how to do this thing, which is prosecute individuals. But there was a backlash, a huge backlash led by the corporate lobby and the white-collar defense bar over the next decade. The Department of Justice also suffered some losses and some internal bureaucratic fiascos, and it sort of compounded along with a bunch of difficult rulings, adverse rulings from the courts. I think that the courts got it wrong a lot because the courts had a kind of libertarian right-wing turn that were much more friendly to white-collar defendants, and that all built up to deprive the DOJ of this ability to really investigate and prosecute well. And they're scared of trials. They don't understand trials. And so they prefer to negotiate settlements with corporations now.
It seems, though, that there has been a backlash to the decision to bail out the big banks in certain ways, some of these big financial organizations that engage in some of this reckless behavior that brought down so much of the economy, and a suspicion about institutions, about Wall Street. Do you see this as a fallout from what the government did?
Suspicion of Wall Street, you mean?
The backlash?
Well, yes, although it's been kind of inchoate and poorly thought out. So one of the things that has been constrained is the Federal Reserve's emergency lending, and that actually is an extraordinarily important tool that the Fed needs and that did save the financial system. And you know, I give a lot of credit to the Federal Reserve and Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson and Tim Geithner subsequently for saving the financial system. I think that they did the right thing there. I think that there were subsequent disastrous mistakes. One of them was that they made a mistake trying to save the financial system. They instead focused on saving individual institutions, saving specific banks, you know, preserving Citigroup. And that was a big mistake. The second, as you discussed, is the lack of accountability mm-hmm. for financial executives. And the third, I think, is not helping homeowners to anywhere near the degree that we help bankers and the individual banks. And that was catastrophic. And we led to this backlash. But the backlash, you know, led to the Tea Party in some way. So the backlash was inchoate and ill-focused and didn't really understand what was going on. But there's clearly anger, and I think it really led to a little bit to Bernie Sanders, certainly to Occupy Wall Street, and then I think you can draw a line to Trump.
In hindsight, what do you think the federal government should have done?
In hindsight, and in fact, this isn't really hindsight because some people were arguing at the time, were several things. One, they should have taken over failing financial institutions so that the government would have taken possession of companies, offered short-term lending, and wiped out shareholders, and then even wiped out some bondholders, or at least given bondholders a haircut, as it's known, sort of that they would have lost money. That would have located the pain properly in the investors who had been reckless and negligent. The government would have taken it over. That would have stabilized the financial system. Taxpayers would have eventually very easily might have profited. The taxpayers did actually profit from some of the bailouts in some ways. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is we should have done much more aggressive helping of homeowners. They're the true victims here. People lost their homes. They were unable to pay their mortgages, and they didn't get nearly as the help that the bankers did and nearly as much help as they should have. The Obama administration did have these programs to help people modify their loans, but it wasn't nearly as successful as it should have been. They didn't focus on it, and they were very trepidatious. They were afraid of the bad politics about it.
Well, certainly today the stock market is frankly, on fire. Unemployment is low. GDP is up. Some parts of the housing market have recovered. Who is still hurting from this great recession of 10 years ago?
Well, there are huge pockets of housing that have not recovered. That's one thing. The second thing is that there was great wealth that was destroyed, and people really haven't recovered their retirement incomes and haven't recovered from their housing wealth. I mean, most people at one point in this country saved money through their homes, and that was destroyed. And the most important thing, I think, is that wages have not recovered nearly as much as financial assets. There's some wage increase just recently in the last year and a half or so, but that's not nearly enough, so that the median income is still down from 2000, down from 2007. And so the average person on the street has not recovered from the Great Recession. The people who have recovered are the 1%, the wealthy bankers, wealthy corporate executives, asset holders. Those people have come back spectacularly, and it's exacerbated inequality and exacerbated the tensions in our political system.
Do you think we're on the cusp of another Great Recession, or that there's one somewhere in our future?
I don't see anything now, which of course should worry everybody, because I just don't think that we're in a bubble now. It's I would be cautious because everything is expensive, but nothing seems really irrationally exuberant. So I think that this recovery has a little bit to go. But I think that we're inevitably going to have a financial crisis. We have financial crises on a regular basis, and it's going to be worse because the Trump administration is rolling back financial regulation way too precipitously, way too aggressively. That's reckless and going to make any financial crisis that we're having much more significant and global than what we could have. We have the tools and know-how to lessen financial crises, to make them much less painful and contain them. And we're sort of forgetting those lessons and throwing away that knowledge and letting the markets run free.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, Jesse, what are those tools you're referring to?
Well, regulation. So the first and most obvious thing is that banks should have a lot more capital, which means that they should borrow less and have shareholders give them money. That wouldn't hurt lending at all, and it would make the financial system much safer. And while banks have increased their capital since the financial crisis, and while their financial system is moderately safer because of it, they probably are woefully undercapitalized. So that's the first and obvious thing. Most people agree on that, and politically they don't want to do it because it would hurt the bank executive's ability to make a lot of money.
We are going to end on that note. Jesse Eisinger, as always, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And he's senior reporter, editor, ProPublica, again, author of a book called The Chicken S Club, Why the Justice Department Fails to Prosecute Executives. Won a Pulitzer Prize a couple of years ago for some of his reporting about some of these questionable Wall Street practices. Well, from fact to fiction, writer Gary Steingart is going to join us in just a minute or so. He's got a new novel called Lake House. It's about a hedge fund manager looking to escape his 1% life. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Barry Cohen is a Wall Street hedge fund manager with a 4,000-square-foot apartment in Manhattan, an obsession with expensive watches, a smart trophy wife, and a young son with autism who can't speak and doesn't make eye contact. The SEC is on Barry's tail, and his marriage is on the rocks. He gets out of town on a Greyhound bus to track down an old girlfriend and sees an America that might as well be a foreign country. Barry Cohen is the protagonist in our guest Gary Steingart's new novel, Lake Success. Steingart spent the summer of 2016 on the Hound, as Greyhound buses are known, traveling the country, and he spent time with hedge fund managers, telling the Wall Street Journal there's a gigantic flair to everything they do, almost like they're living in a Russian novel. Steingart was born in Russia and immigrated to the States with his parents when he was a little boy. This is his fifth book, and it is his fifth appearance on Radio Times. Gary Steingart, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be back, as always.
Nice to have you with us. Let's begin with a reading from the very beginning of your new book.
Sure. This is the first page of Lake Success. Barry Cohen, a man with $2.4 billion of assets under management, staggered into the Port Authority bus terminal. He was visibly drunk and bleeding. There was a clean slice above his left brow where the nanny's fingernail had gouged him and, from his wife, a teardrop scratch below his eyes. It was 3:20 a.m. The last time he had been to the Port Authority was 24 years ago. He had gone on a bus trip to Richmond, Virginia to see his college girlfriend. That youthful bus ride unspooled in his mind whenever the S&P was crushing him or whenever he would discover a new and terrible fact about his son's condition. When Barry closed his eyes, he could picture the sweep of the highway, his country calling out to him from both sides of the road. He could feel himself sitting on a hard wooden bench at some roadside shack. A thick woman with a crab-like walk and many stories to tell would bring him a plate of vinegary beans and pulled pork. They would talk as equals about where their lives went wrong, and she would waive the price of the meal, and he would pay for it anyway, and she would say, "Thank you, Barry," because despite the vast difference in their assets under management, they would already be on a first-name basis.
Gary Steingart reading from the very beginning of his new novel, Lake Success. I liked Barry, in spite of his biography, the fact that he is in many ways part of that reviled 1%.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of one of the missions I set for myself is, you know, I don't want to humanize the bankers and the hedge funds and private equity people who have, as we've heard in the previous segment, contributed so much to our country's sad state of affairs. But, you know, books, fiction, it's about human beings. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to uncover at least something good about somebody who has such an unfortunate relationship to the universe at large.
Was that hard for you to find that humanity, that heart in Barry?
It was very hard. This was the hardest character I've ever written.
Really?
Usually, of course. I mean, usually I have these sort of underdogs, you know, these sort of post-Soviet Jewish nebbishes like myself trying to make their way through America. And here is, I wanted to write about somebody who had a position of power that he didn't really deserve. And to sort of deal with that, I needed to set up obstacles, of course. So there's a marriage that he is a horrifying participant in, although right. His wife also is no bed of roses. But mostly it was a story about a father and a son. And the son is autistic, and Barry, who seeks perfection in everything he does, of course, seeks out perfection in his child. And the book is about autism in some ways, but it's also about a father coming to terms with the fact that he is a father.
And you are a father. Was that in part what got you thinking about what is at stake when one becomes a parent?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, my other books have all been about young people, sometimes people in the middle age, but they've always been without children. And I think once I've had a child and realized that I am, as expected, a very anxious father, being a very anxious human being in general.
Are we all anxious parents?
I think I kind of take the cake. I think I'm the Anxious Father of the Year award winner for 2018. And, you know, I have a lovely kid who's great, but I still can't help but constantly worry.
Do you worry about?
I think there's two folds of worry. One is worry, of course, just, you know, oh, will he like his new kindergarten? Will he like this? Will he like that? And the second worry is, of course, growing up in a country that's in a wild state of decline. I grew up in the Soviet Union, and the one thing my parents knew what to do was when to leave. You know, I'm not saying we're there yet, but they did know, as you said, when to get out. And so that's something that I obviously have to keep my eye on, because if this continues the way it does, this will be a very difficult country to raise a child in. It already is.
You feel that way? I mean, clearly, if you look at children being separated at the border, sure. I mean, that's one story. Certainly the gap between rich and poor. We've got many children growing up in poverty, deep poverty in this country.
Sure. I mean, my son has a birth certificate that says New York, New York, but the administration has been trying to denaturalize people. They claim some kind of phony, you know, they haven't filled out their form correctly or something. But I think this is a start to something very dangerous, a kind of blood and soil neo-fascist kind of approach to citizenship. You know, who is a citizen? And as somebody who wasn't born here, you know, right now I'm a citizen. But what they're saying is it's all up for grabs. We determine who is a citizen, not the Constitution, not anyone else.
Or a document.
Or a document, exactly.
You mentioned about Barry and that you normally your characters are Jewish and Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, he is.
He is Jewish.
He's Jewish for sure. But he is
baby steps.
He's also a Nebish, don't you think?
He's a Nebish who wants to not be a Nebish, you know. And usually my characters embrace their Nebishhood. There's a kind of hipster Nebish movement, Warby Parker glasses and all, you know, that kind of has permeated both coasts, so to speak. But this guy thinks he's actually refers to himself as the friendliest guy in the street, being Wall Street.
Right. And
throughout the book, we wonder if he himself has some tendencies toward the spectrum. When he grew up, he taught himself these so-called friend moves, which
he would practice in front of the mirror.
So somebody says, "Hey, what did you do?" And he would say, "I went to the mall." And as a child, I didn't speak English, and so I had to practice in front of a mirror. I had no social cues to pick up on. So I would also say, "You know, I went to North Shore Mall and bought thing there." So Barry and I have some kind of affinity for each other there, at least.
You did spend some time. I don't know if it was actual research or spent time with hedge fund managers. Was that in part for the book?
Yeah, no, entirely
to
for
understand
the book.
This world.
Yeah, I would not do this on my own free time. But the book sort of started because I realized all my friends were gone from Manhattan. There was nobody left, and even Brooklyn now is just too expensive. They're all in Berlin or Abu Dhabi or Philadelphia, so I realized nobody's left, so I started to look around at who is left, and it was basically people in finance. So I spent 3 years hanging out with them. They were difficult years. I drank more than I ever have. I'm Russian. I can probably drink a little, but this was just...
This is even beyond the Russian scale?
This was beyond the Russian scale. My liver is seeking asylum in Estonia. I mean, it was a disaster, and especially in 2017 when all the funds really began to tank and they started to really take it out on their own bodies. But also, the big takeaway was these were not happy people. I mean... The previous guest was talking about how the system is rigged in favor of the 1%, how in fact all the money they're getting is a kind of tax on the rest of those. The 99% of us get taxed. All this money gets transferred to them through, various loopholes and et cetera. But they're not even happy with all that money. They're some of the more miserable people I've ever met. It's a kind of lose-lose situation for the entire country, and Lake Success is in part about that.
Do they know they're unhappy?
No, I don't think they do. I mean, I think... They think they're unhappy when the markets are down or when their portfolios are down. That's when they think they're unhappy. They don't quite recognize the estrangement that they feel from their communities, which they don't partake in because there is no community. There's their apartment on the Upper East Side, their fund in Midtown, their house in the Hamptons, their club back in Midtown. There's nothing else. It's almost like living in a gated community in the middle of Manhattan. Mm-hmm. So they're estranged from their community. They're often estranged from their wives who hate them, who are bought into this very gilded version but have themselves are so well educated and credentialed that spending their lives taking care of their four kids does not seem like, the highest thing they could be doing with their time. They're estranged from their kids, whom also they don't understand whether they're on the spectrum or not. So it's not a happy existence by any means.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Gary Steingart, and we're talking about his new novel, Lake Success. It's his fifth novel, and you're getting a sense about what it is about. It's about many things, including America. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Interestingly, Barry, I guess everything these days has something to do with Donald Trump. But nonetheless, Barry is a Marco Rubio supporter. And I was interested of all those, 16 candidates that he chose Marco Rubio.
Yeah, yeah. He, of course, admired his immigrant gumption and all that stuff. But he also, or that of his parents. And of course, he's, he, as he will say on almost every page, I'm fiscally conservative but socially liberal. And the book is sort of, in a way, disentangles that concept, the fact that can you be, fiscally conservative and still think that your way is helping the country when so much of people's lives depends on, creating a more even playing field, disentangling us from this ridiculous income inequality that only continues to grow and would continue to grow under a Rubio presidency for sure, and is certainly galloping ahead under a Trump presidency.
Barry Cohen, I mean, his dad, his mother dies when he's young. His dad is a pool cleaner.
Yeah.
So he's not of the manner born by any stretch of the imagination. Was that what you found when you hung out with hedge fund managers?
Quite a bit, yeah. I would say that a lot of the people I met were what I would categorize as lower middle class and often coming from the peripheries of places. So Barry, like myself, comes from the very edge of Queens, Little Neck, Queens. Many people I met came from peripheries of Naples or, you know, or Moscow or L.A. I mean, they were always sort of lower middle class looking in, you know. And that – I'm not going to equate that with Trump, of course, because Trump grew up quite wealthy. And, in fact, without his wealth would have never been anyone. But in his mind, being in Queens and always looking at Manhattan was the sort of the big journey. And that's the journey that I also undertook as well in my own life, you know.
Were you I read somewhere that you had a time in your life where you were interested in finance?
Oh, yeah. When I was a kid, I mean, look, I was a poor kid in a very, you know, not a very wealthy, but a fairly wealthy yeshiva. Everyone else seemed a lot wealthier than I was, and everyone made fun of me. I had an accent. I had this big fur coat from Russia that smelled of gerbil. I mean, it was not a great scenario. So I remember the movie Wall Street came out, and I thought, wow, this is the way to do it, you know. And I was like, what's wrong with a little insider trading? I mean, go Bud Fox, yeah.
So how come that didn't work out?
Well,
how come he became a writer instead?
I went to Oberlin.
You went to Oberlin.
I mean, that takes
care
of that,
right? That wouldn't have worked at Oberlin at all.
The first thing they said is, you know, you're going to be a writer, so don't even bother making money. Yeah.
Well, what's the real story there, though?
Well, I did always want to write. And my parents always said, well, that's a nice hobby to have, you know, but you should go to law school or something. Yeah. But always try to be a writer on the side, you know. Chekhov was a doctor, you know. Why can't you do this either? But it really was a place like Oberlin where, you know, I started workshopping my stories, and my fellow students and professors really liked them and encouraged me. It was very encouraging that way. And also my money lust kind of began to fade away during those years because, I mean, it was the Oberlin environment, but also it was this – when you become a writer and you try to probe into the human condition, you're also probing into yourself. And I realized that some way that having a lot of money just wasn't going to do it for me. It would just be this endless desire for more money without any, you know, without any real payoff.
But do you see yourself as successful? I mean, I've read a little bit about you, and I know you have a nice apartment. I think it's on Gramercy Park somewhere.
Not really.
You have a
close.
Dacha up in upstate New York. I mean, do you feel like in – that you are living that American dream?
Yeah. I mean, every immigrant wants to buy a piece of property. That's sort of – that is the immigrant dream.
Right.
So I don't even think about the apartment. You know, you have to have an apartment if you're going to live in New York. Obviously, I'm not going to live in the street, but the dacha and the actual plot beneath it is the American dream. The fact that there are deer right now, American deer grazing on American grass – that's really all I've ever wanted. And in fact, after finishing this novel and after 3 years of hanging out with hedge funders, I never want anything more, any other possession. I've become almost allergic to money. I've seen the end game of it. It's not a happy end game.
You did spend pretty much the summer of 2016 on a greyhound.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that the greyhound is called either the dog or the hound.
The dog or the hound. Oh, yeah.
Which is has a kind of poetry in and of itself.
It's its own part of America, you know. It's a fascinating part of America. It's at one point Barry notes that people talk about where they went to prison on the hound the way people on the Acela talk about where they went to law school, and that and many of the people I met were, you know, many were wearing a bracelet from a mental institution or had just left a correctional institution. It was a really different part of America than you see. But it was as important a part of America as any I'd ever seen.
Is it the real America?
I hate that thing about the real America. I really do, you know, because, yes, on the one hand, I did see an America that is so important for writers, journalists, for everybody to get on a hound or a dog or what have you and get out there. But I don't want to diminish the fact that, I mean, what, are people on the coast not real Americans?
Sure.
Are those of us that, you know, that live in major cities, I mean, we're probably, what, half the population, if not more. How are we not real Americans too?
Interestingly, though, and there's a scene, maybe he's not on the bus, but he's somewhere in America at a bar. And there's a conversation about Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and a guy, I think in pink shorts, says,
yes,
she's a liar. This is about Hillary. Yeah. Trump is going to win. And Barry says, you know, basically I grew up in New York, and how much was that a part of some of the conversations you had?
Sure. I mean, look, most people in New York realize that we've always known Trump as a schmuck. There's no, you know, and not a great businessman. In fact, many of the hedge funders I met told me, you know, I would never give him money, and he's come for money, and we're just not going to give it to him. So he was able to sort of, you know, entice the rest of America into buying into, you know, Trump stakes and whatnot. But there, that scene really happened. There was a bar in Atlanta where a group of men came up and we were started talking, and they said, you know, she's going to lose not just Ohio but Pennsylvania. And I thought, what are you, nuts? This was like, you know, July or something like that. But all along the ride, people kept telling me that Trump was going to win. And I kept thinking, well, let me look up 538.com here. You're obviously completely wrong. But I kept getting, you know, getting my polls handed back to me. And that was instructive. People somehow knew.
They knew something.
They knew something. I mean, look, in some ways, this was a beautiful ride. America's still a lovely country. You look out the window of the hound, and my God, you know, from Arizona to North Carolina, there's so much beauty in this country. But I also met my first white supremacist who talked about crucifying Muslims and Jews, which is a scene that went into the book. And Barry runs out and buys a New Testament coloring book in Shreveport, Louisiana to convince
Did you do that?
I looked at it. I mean, it was, you know, it was a little frightening, but... but I also met lovely people who were on their way up, you know, people who were making their way in America despite all the handicaps they had because of race and gender and class, et cetera.
Happier than the hedge fund managers you met?
Well, you're always happier when you still have something that you want to accomplish. You know, I'm not sure what these hedge funders want to accomplish. They want more money. The money doesn't really do anything. It's just a score sheet. It's, you know, many of them play poker after they're finished trading, which is almost the same thing as trading. And they're playing against the same people they traded with during the daytime. So it's like an addiction, you know. But the happiest people I think I've met were people like professors at UTEP, University of Texas at El Paso, who were working with first-generation students both from El Paso and from across the border in Ciudad Juarez in Mexico. And they genuinely – they weren't just working with abstract figures on a Bloomberg terminal. They were helping people, you know. I mean, that's something.
That is something. And that's Gary Steingart, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's got a new novel, Lake Success, and it's his fifth book, and he's at the Free Library of Philadelphia tonight at 7:30. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you are just joining us, our guest is writer Gary Steingart. We're talking about his new novel called Lake Success, about a hedge fund manager named Barry Cohen looking to escape his 1% life. He gets on the Greyhound bus to try to find an old girlfriend. Gary Steingart was talking about the fact that he took the hound back in 2016 during the presidential campaign. He also immigrated to the U.S. with his parents from Russia when he was a little boy. I do want to talk, as you mentioned, in many ways, and I felt this very strongly. This is a lot about fathers and sons. And Barry's father is tough on his son.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure exactly what word to use, but how do you see their relationship?
Well, you know, I see, and this is true of a lot of the hedge fund people I've met. People would often say to me, I'd say, why does, you know, Biff behave the way he does? And the answer was invariably, his mommy didn't love him, you know. And here I wanted to take the mother out of the picture entirely. She died when Barry was 5 years old. But he has a father who also was from a long generation of unloved sons. Growing up in the Bronx, you know, very lower middle class, and continuing that kind of lower middle class legacy is not somebody who did better than his parents. You know, he's kind of an example of the new America where each generation does not do better than the past. And so I wanted Barry to have that as – to have no ability to nothing to learn from his father when it came to his own when it came time to, for him to be a father as well. And also Barry, like many of the people I've met, because their earlier lives were so imperfect, he now requires perfection of everything. So he marries a 28-year-old woman who he says, according to him, has the perfect eggs, you know, because she's so young and the perfect genetics because she's so beautiful, and she also, you know, went to Yale Law School. So this is a done deal, and he dreams of having three perfect children. And in his upstate house, his summer house, he builds a bathroom with three sinks next to one another so that the children can play together mirthfully. And then, of course, his child is nonverbal and autistic.
Right.
And everything
doesn't
goes
make ahead. Eye contact.
Doesn't make eye contact. But, you know, so there's really no way for Barry to communicate with him. There are ways to communicate with a child on the spectrum, but Barry, you know, does not have the facility to do that. And his wife is desperately trying to. And there's a whole team of social workers and nannies and therapists, et cetera, who are trying to help her out.
In fact, it's I think in many ways the reason he leaves New York. Yes, he's got the SEC on his tail, but in many ways it's impossible for him to figure out how to be a father to this child.
Yeah, the myth of perfection has been destroyed. And I think he loves his child. And I think throughout the book, you know, there's at one point I think he thinks, wow, I haven't thought about him for three pages or something like that, you know, because he's dying to have a relationship with his child. And he meets children along the way that he loves, that he falls in love with and wants to help, who are not on the spectrum or who are at least on the more, perhaps on the verbal part of the spectrum. And you know, there's a real longing there. It's not that he's just a complete jerk. He wants to connect so desperately, and all he can connect with are mechanical objects like this giant watch collection, which he has, which he takes with him because he is a watch collector.
As are you.
in a very sad middle-aged way. I have been collecting watches, and I've been obsessed with them. I think it started, and I did a piece for The New Yorker about this in 2016, I think, when I realized that Trump had a chance, I said, I can't just focus on, you know, reading the news anymore. It's just going to make me suicidal. So I started to look at watch sites. It could have been anything. It could have been baseball statistics. But for some reason, the mechanical watch has a steadily ticking hand that moves across the dial. And that calmed me down. It kind of my shrink said, you know, just as the shrink says to Barry, when you're feeling anxious, look at your watch and let the second hand calm you down. And that's what I started to do. And then I started to buy a few of them, and I became quite good at it. And in fact, unlike people's portfolios, mine have actually gone up in value, which is bizarre.
It is bizarre. And not to give too much away, at one point, Barry has this fantasy, to some degree, I guess it comes true, of building a watchatarium, right?
A watcharium.
A watcharium, right. Which, filled with watches.
Yes, it's like his own little watch den, which by the way, I don't have.
So you controlled yourself at least that far. But I like watches, and I like the analog. It's interesting that digital watches never really took off. That there's something about a watch face, and Barry keeps saying to his son or to himself, you know, please talk, please look at me. And the thought that he could look at a watch face, but he couldn't look at his father's face.
Yeah, well, the watch does what it is meant to do. I mean, it keeps ticking. When he looks at his son, he doesn't quite see that connection, and it kills him. And, you know, I don't want to give away too much of the book, but the son has his own journey. The son is not static. And there's a lot of stuff that happens to him and with him. And there's some hope, too, you know.
I'm also curious about, and he does meet some young children, some boys along the way, as you mentioned, sort of not exactly adopts them, but he relates to them. He wants to know them. And there's a scene in the book where he talks about this place that he fantasized about when he was a kid called Lake Success. I wonder if you could read that for us.
Sure. And just to set this up, this kid, Joan, is as obsessed with maps as Barry is with watches. So he has his own very intense focus on something. And then Barry remembered his own thing with maps. How could he have forgotten for all these years? When I was your age, I had a map of Long Island, Barry said, and I would look at it every day. You did? Jonah said. Really? There was a kind of tremor to his fingers when he was excited. He moved his thumb along the rest of his fingers as if counting them or making sure they were still there. Yeah, I was obsessed with this one town on Long Island called Lake Success. Barry squinted, trying to make out the town somewhere between Great Neck, Long Island, and his own Queens neighborhood. But maybe it was too small for the boy to have drawn in. Why Lake Success? Jonah asked. The two of them were close enough to be touching elbows. I don't know, Barry said. I just really liked the name. I wanted to be successful. I was living with my father. My mother had gone. They got divorced, something like that. And you couldn't visit her twice a year? She had gone to a different country. The point was, I didn't get along with my dad. He wasn't as nice as your mom. So I wanted to move somewhere. And Lake Success has this shopping center. And all the houses had these awesome backyards. And you could put a pool in. My dad cleaned pools, but we didn't have one. And I kept that map under my bed all the time. It was an Exxon map from the gas station.
I really like that section. I mean, it says so much. Did you have a Lake Success as a kid?
Yes, and it was Lake Success.
And it was Lake Success. Okay. All the pieces are beginning to fall together now.
So,
I like that.
So people say, you know, that this is my least autobiographical novel because it's not about a Russian dude. But in some ways, of course, every writer harvests his or her material endlessly. And for me, like Barry, I grew up in Little Neck, which was when Barry and I were growing up, there was a kind of working class Irish Italian neighborhood, lots of firefighter cops, that sort of thing. And now I think more is Korean, Indian. It's changing. But whatever the case, I remember looking over the border to Lake Success with great, great
like the Emerald
envy.
City, in
it
a way?
It really was the Emerald City. It had a really awful strip mall, which, you know, but back then, just because it had the title Success attached to it, I fetishized it, you know, all I could, even though it was a really bad mall, still is. And it was just the name. The name was so beautiful. A Great Neck and adjoining village had the word great in it. We were little. They were great. And this other place was Success. I mean, everything was set up for this, like, Gatsby-esque, right, you know, wonderland.
You mentioned the fact that in this novel, Barry's father, they have a difficult relationship. He's shy. His father really does belittle him. You wrote a memoir called Little Failure, you know, since we're right, putting this real life in this novel together here. Should we make a connection there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, there's obviously some connection, a tough, gruff, conservative father. I mean, I think my father was a lot funnier than this particular specimen. And I think, gentler in his own ways and also faced with more difficulties. My father grew up, I mean, his first memory growing up was the Luftwaffe was strafing the train under which he was hiding as they left Leningrad during the siege for the Ural Mountains. So, you know, he has a little bit more of an excuse to be the kind of person he is, whereas, Barry's dad grew up in the Bronx. I guess that's a kind of trauma, too.
Different kind of trauma
than being strafed by the Luftwaffe, yeah.
Would your dad talk about that part of Russia? Oftentimes with immigrants, they sort of shut the door or turn their back on their past.
Yeah, and he talked a lot for Little Failure. And the nice sort of thing from that memoir for me was that I got hours upon hours of audio recordings. I took him back to Russia, and a lot of the stuff there sparked his memories. So absolutely, yeah.
You wrote a book called Absurdistan. Yeah. This was a novel a number of years ago. Is the United States becoming Absurdistan?
Absolutely. You know, when I wrote Absurdistan, I kept thinking that, look, the Soviet Union had collapsed, and there was this feeling that over the years, the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, the countries thereof, would become more and more like America. Rule of law, civil society, equitable free markets, stuff like that, you know. But with the exception of the Baltics, it was the opposite. We became more and more like Russia, you know. I mean, I think our president looks at Putin and thinks, this is great. He doesn't fully understand, he's not an intellectual enough to understand exactly what the components of that regime are, but he sees kleptocracy, he loves it, he sees the fact that the press has almost no role in the society, everything is state-controlled, and he says, wow, that's perfect, why can't we just have Fox and Friends and nothing more? So it's a real inspiration for him, I think.
Does that scare you?
Yes, that's why, you know, we're all... When I got on the Hound, you know, I was, like I said, I was convinced Hillary would win. When I got off the Hound, I was pricing Toronto real estate, you know.
It
was,
were you really?
Yeah.
I mean,
well, looking at it. Actually, Montreal is my preferred Canadian city. But, you know, and I love this country so much. I hope it doesn't come to that. But you know, it's always good to, I'm a sap, a Soviet Ashkenazi pessimist. It's always good to plan the next step.
And a worrier, as you said.
And a huge worrier. but I think, I mean, you know, I've written dystopias before. I wrote the super sad true love story when Obama was president. And, you know, things were rosier. But I do have a kind of feeling about this country. And I think, you know, growing up in a failed superpower, I think I have a kind of failed superpower sensor almost. And it's pinging.
I wonder whether, and there is satire, obviously, in a lot of what you have written, whether that's a a cover for either anger or mm-hmm. worry or sadness.
Or all three.
Or all three, yes.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, and I think this book has a little more sadness than the other books. Mm-hmm. And I think it is, going back to the first thing you asked me about, I think it is about being a parent, you know, because if I didn't have a kid right now, I'd say, well, yes, the world is falling apart, but, you know, it'll fall mm-hmm. apart without me. But knowing that there'll be a little person who has to deal with all of this, and we're not even, you know, the political part is one thing, but the environmental part is, I think, even going to be even bigger, much larger of a picture. You know, I mean, we're raising a kid on a coast that may soon be underwater. So, you know, all these things figure greatly when I think about the new kind of sadness that I've discovered in writing a book about parenthood. I hope the book is still funny, but the humor is there's definitely a much more tragicomic element to it than previous works.
And can you relate to or understand, if not that desire for the perfect child, at least a child that can and you know, Barry, they're embarrassed. They are embarrassed of their child.
They are embarrassed.
Barry and his wife, because he's not doing what other children do.
Right, right. And remember that Manhattan is this endless competition for not just, you know, hedge funder of the year and hedge fund wife of the year, but also, you know, child of the year. And people are so ridiculous about it. It's like an arms race. There's a scene in here, which I copied from real life, where Barry's wife, Seema, says, you know, oh, I'm so happy with the diversity of my kid's school. And this happened to me, and she mentioned the school, this very prestigious school, and I said, that's not a very diverse school. And she said, no, you don't understand. Some of these fathers, they're not even hedge fund managers. They're just doctors or lawyers.
And that was from real life then.
That was from real life, as many of these things were. Yeah.
A question from Kate says, does Gary Steingart see any way forward for America to turn things around? And if so, these are the questions we now ask novelists, right?
That's pathetic that novelists are now charged with changing the country around.
Right.
Look, I don't want to be very prescriptive. I mean, obviously the things – I mean, how do you turn things around? The first thing you do is you go to a bookstore, a real bookstore, and you buy a book. I think – I don't know why, but that creates a tiny little ripple across the world, across society, and you turn off Facebook. In fact, maybe you delete Facebook if you're really ahead of the game.
Did you do that?
I didn't, because I have to hawk my book, but I never do anything personal there. It's always, you know, hey, buy my book. You know, I use it as a commercial tool, but not as a way to really interact. You know, I don't put my family on there. It's not for that. These are very dangerous times and very dangerous things, Facebook, all the rest of it. So by buying a book and not doing Facebook, I think you are already contributing hugely to the state of our country's possible redemption.
There's a fair amount of sex in this book, I should say. And at one point, I guess Barry's saying, you know, that, or you write, that no one kissed anymore since the internet, which I assume is some reference to pornography on the internet.
Sure. I mean, the internet has really pornified things, but also has, you know, kissing is a form of very intimate communication. And I think social media has destroyed that form of communication, where we're all just either showing off how, you know, wealthy we are, sexy we are, how perfect our families are. It destroys any sense of imperfection. And glory be to imperfection and imperfect children and imperfect parents and all of us being not 100% of what we should be, because that is life and humanity and fiction.
We're almost out of time here. You made a reference to something from The Lady with the Dog as a kind of perfect sentence. We're almost out of time here, but I'll read it. And it seemed as though in a little while the solution would be found, and then a new and glorious life would begin. And it was clear to both of them that they still had a long, long road before them, and that the most complicated and difficult part of it was only just beginning.
I love it. It's a perfect Chekhov sentence at the end of Lady with the Dog. And I think it's, you know, it starts out with a kind of American hubris. Yes, a perfect life is possible if we only do more headspace and yoga and blah, blah, blah. But then it throws a kind of Russian water on it, saying, yes, but basically they're always going to be striving for this thing and they would never attain it. And that's life.
Well, always a pleasure. Gary Steingart, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And again, his new book is a novel. It's his fifth book, and it is called Lake Success. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. We'll take some photos of Gary Steingart, our guest, which we will post on Facebook after the show. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.